Joan of Arc. The name has passed into legend around the world, the Maid of Orléans lifted up into Catholic sainthood. Her story has been reimagined, retold, and adapted over and over again, from Mark Twain's novelization to the modern day setting of the show Joan of Arcadia. Surely among the many prophets of the world, the life of Joan of Arc qualifies as words and deeds of prophetic people, which challenge us to confront powers and structures of evil with justice, compassion, and the transforming power of love, one of the adopted sources of our Unitarian Universalist faith. What does hearing her name bring into your mind? Was she an Illuminata commanded by God to save France from annihilation? Was she mentally ill, suffering from hallucinations, and caught up in the superstitions of her time? Or was she just a really brave girl who heard about a prophecy and decided it would be her? These are the kinds of questions that follow her legacy around in these modern times, and I believe they detract from it. For me, it does not matter whether or not her voices were from God. What matters is her choices, her actions, and what she inspired in the people around her. For a girl whose name calls up so many questions about the truth of vision and the nature of religious devotion, the details of her life are known in unquestionable detail through the records of the Hundred Years' War and court transcripts of her multiple trials. Whether they were visions or hallucinations, she first saw her angels while she was working in one of the fields of her family's farm. Though she had no contacts, no training, no resources, she couldn't read. She defied her father, who testified in one of those trials that he would have rather drowned her himself than see her follow her notions of going to war. She made her way through the wrecked countryside to the seat of the local nobility near her village, where she petitioned again and again to be sent to the Dauphin, the man who she believed should be the king of France. When Joan came into his life, he was about to flee France altogether, as we heard Mark Twain describe. And each step on Joan's path from that first appearance in the village is the same, with only the names and places changing and the threat to her life increasing. At each fork in the road, from her village to Vaucouleurs, to the Dauphin's castle, to her first trial at Poitiers, to the siege of Orléans, all the way to the king's coronation at Reims, she faced the crushing doubt of very powerful men, the mocking laughter of her fellow citizens, and grueling examinations, both verbal and physical, just to determine her worthiness to speak, much less act. And each time, without fail, through the perseverance of her words and deeds and her unyielding faith, she turned every single one of them to her cause. At first, she was just kind of a mascot for the people of France to rally around. But after the victory at Orléans, she was placed in charge of tactical decisions. She was given special dispensation by the Catholic Church to wear men's clothing. She was equipped with personalized armor, and she was given her own war banner. In the span of just a few short weeks, she rose from being perceived as a delusional peasant girl to a general-in-chief on the fields of battle. To quote 19th century Hungarian President Lajos Kossuth, "Since the writing of human history began, Joan of Arc is the only person of any sex who has ever held supreme command of the military forces of a nation at the age of 17. And she did not just send this army into battle, she joined them. One story is told of how Joan took an arrow to the neck and kept fighting until they had won. I would not be able to do that, I'm just saying. What is even more significant is the action she inspired in the soldiers and farmers who fought those battles with her. In real war, there is the march to the field, the nightly camps, the councils of war. And it was during this downtime that she taught this peasant army a better way to live, of the orthopraxis that must follow any orthodoxy, of the right way of living that must follow any sort of claimed right belief. She sent the whores away who were following the men. She outlawed gambling, and she made each of them promise to stop swearing, something else I would not be able to do. She told them not that God would win them the battle if they raised their swords, but that battles would be won only when they gave their life to God's commandments. Right action had to be performed in the world before the world would return any semblance of righteous victory. She did not just reclaim the land for France. She reclaimed its souls as well. Her life was one of relentless, hyper-focused vigilance on her mission. Regardless of whether or not she had hallucinations or true visions of the saints and angels of heaven, it was the faith imparted to her by her community, by the people around her in her village, by her family, that enabled her to leave home and find her way through one barrier after another until she could crown the rightful King of France. When Chelsea Henry, today's worship associate, and I were discussing this service and where we wanted to go with all the so many possibilities that come out of Joan's life, Chelsea lifted up the unification of the tribes in Standing Rock to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline. What we learned from Joan, she said, is that it doesn't matter how things have been done in the past. It doesn't matter what entrenched systems of power or oppression or warfare have been at work, nor for how long. When the heart of our vision calls for us to rise up and claim a better world, we must do so. For Joan, it was freeing her people from the ravages of a 100-year war, a war that existed longer than the memories of everyone alive at the time. Just think, no one could remember a time when they were not at war with England, that their farms were not devastated and burned, that there were not soldiers everywhere. And this young girl said, surely we can know something different. But Joan's story does not end with the coronation. It continues on into tragedy. This is the part that everyone knows. She's burned at the stake, 19 years old. What doesn't always make it into the retelling is that she was captured by the English and the King of France, the man who owed this girl his crown, refused to pay her ransom. He abandoned her in her most dire hour of need, and she was sold to a kangaroo English court bent on destroying her just to send a message. From this point on, in the hands of the enemy, everything is rigged against her. In the end, the English had to resort to lying to convict her. Because she couldn't read, they convinced her to sign a document relinquishing her right to wear men's clothing, telling her that it said something else. And so, the next time she put on a pair of pants, they set her on fire. The worst part is that at the end, when she saw that she was truly, actually going to die, that she had been abandoned thoroughly by the country that she had saved, and that there was no one else around her willing to help her, that her community was gone, she recanted. She broke. The things that it had given her strength were nowhere to be found. And so, of course, one human being cannot carry so much of herself without being destroyed. This is the blessing of the gathered community. This is the power of our covenants together, our promises of how we will be with each other. It's not about being nice. It's a little bit about being nice, but not all about being nice. It's about support and love and hope that we will care for each other through the best of times and the worst of times. I turn to the words of Iuskin American Horse and his people, the words of the hundreds of First Nation tribes that are gathering right now with Standing Rock, putting aside centuries of conflict among each other to fight for a common purpose. It does not matter what has been for the last 100 years or more of the iron grip that white colonization and white corporations have had on the land and the people for so long. The protectors of the land are rising up together to say, no more. We will not do things this way anymore. And what they are protecting is not only sacred tribal land, but also access to clean water. Water is life for them, for you, for me. Water is life for our children and our children's children. Water is the future. Like the Unitarian Universalists who answered the call to Selma in the 1960s, UUs, both lay people and ministers, are also traveling to Standing Rock, are there right now, and asking our local protectors how they can help. But of course, not all of us can go to Standing Rock, and that's okay. Each of us is capable of contributing to the greater vision in our own way. That was part of the covenant we made with our new members, and it applies to all of us. We don't have to do everything. We just have to find the gift that we personally have to offer. Joan may have left home to go lead an army and stop a 100-year war, but we might not know anything of her story if not for her mother. Remember, she'd been thrown away by the French and convicted by the English. And Joan, the hero, only entered our cultural consciousness because of her mother, an uneducated peasant woman with no power, who was so desperate to redeem her daughter that she went again and again and petitioned over and over for her daughter to be retried posthumously, just so that history would not remember her daughter as evil. And eventually she succeeded. Some things do run in families. Each of us has different gifts to bend the moral arc of the universe, different ways we can choose to live out our vision of a better world. Joan took on war. Iuskin American Horse is taking on big oil. Joan's mother took on bureaucracy. The Reverend Robin Tanner, one of our UU ministers in Charlotte, North Carolina, goes out on the streets of her city every night and puts the peaceful protesters up on Facebook Live, showing the world how they sing in their grief. All of these people working against huge, entrenched systems of oppression and doing so in the best ways that they know how. Joan could not have taken back France without earning the support of her army. Joan's mother could not have vindicated her daughter without someone finally supporting her bid for a retrial. Reverend Tanner is supporting the protesters, and we in turn support her and the protesters by witnessing what is happening. Words and deeds of prophetic people, as a source of our faith, calls us not just to learn about the prophets of our history, but to remember those lessons so we do not repeat our mistakes. Joan of Arc teaches us that we must rise up with the prophets of today and stay with them in whatever ways we are able in order to change the world for the better. Be faithful in small things, says Saint Teresa of Calcutta, for it is in them that our strength lies. May it be so.